Welcome to this week's Reaction Podcast. This is Alistair Benn, a Reaction's Deputy Editor. I'm joined by Rachel Cunliffe, a Reaction Correspondent, and Ian Martin, Editor of Reaction. If you like what you hear, please do subscribe to us on our website, which you can find at www.reaction.life, and you can read all our writing there and sign up for offers and newsletters and all the other things that we do. This week, we're going to ask a pretty simple question. Is the government adrift? Why might that be the case? Or the counterfactual, is the government doing a splendid job and managing everything just fine? Rachel, we've seen a few announcements come out over the last few days, lots more guidance. What are your thoughts on it all?
Well, whatever you think about the government's policy going forward, and we can go into the details of that later, I think the comms strategy this week has been abysmal. A whole load of details were leaked to the press leading up to the big announcement last night, saying basically lockdown would be over on Monday, which obviously it isn't. And then the Prime Minister gave this televised address last night, which really didn't clarify things and was mostly talking about getting people back to work, but seemed quite contradictory. They changed their slogan from stay at home to stay alert. So there's been some confusion over what that actually means. Personally, I think that's quite a good slogan, but the point is that they did it without informing the other devolved nations. So they've got that problem as well. And then the detail as to what the policy actually was didn't come out until a couple of hours ago. So we've had almost 24 hours of speculation with various ministers briefing contradictory things. The guidance has now come out and the Prime Minister has been in Parliament talking about said guidance and has been contradicting what's in his own document. So whatever the policy is, they have really, really messed up their messaging here, which doesn't inspire much confidence.
You're right.
In my opinion.
A good example of that is actually coming back to the stay alert slogan. Now, Emmanuel Macron in France has adopted a slogan, which is Restez Prudent, which is as close to stay alert as you can really get in a colloquial terms. Maybe restez vigilant is the closest thing to stay alert. So it's not like stay alert is a fatuous thing to say or an outlier compared to what other governments are advising. What is weird is, as you point out, on the devolved issue, there is a reasonable explanation for the difference in advice for the devolved governments. If you look at the data, which has just been released on the ONS, of where the infection is worst, it is in Wales and Scotland at the moment in terms of cases per 100,000 people. England is second lowest, only compared to Northern Ireland. Wales is the top. So that is the reasonable explanation for why the guidance is more aggressive in Scotland and Wales. But then it seemed to come out over Sunday from the SNP that they didn't know that the guidance was being changed in England, which is weird. There's always a reasonable explanation, which I'm always ready to give, and then sometimes there's just the slightly vulgar one, which might actually be correct.
Is the explanation on that, Alistair, in terms of Wales and Scotland being the epicentre, is that simply that Wales and Scotland are slightly behind on the spread?
Well, it might be. So if you look on, I mentioned it without really prefacing what I'm talking about. The ONS, one, Boris in his speech talked a lot about how the government going forward was going to be guided by what he called a sort of biosecurity strategy with this mooted biosecurity centre, where you'd have a smarter form of lockdown at a local and a regional and a national level, informed by real-time tracking of the disease. And that would be done through ONS surveys. And the ONS has today put up the preliminary or the first stages of that. And you can look at which regions are at the moment seeing the worst caseloads in terms of the numbers recorded in the official numbers. It's really interesting, actually. And in Scotland, it is Scotland may be on a different epidemic curve to England, Wales the same. I don't know. It makes you wonder why we all went into a national lockdown when we did, apart from the politics. Because it seems to me not appropriate to manage the thing as we're going forward as one, which is what we're already recognising, which is a good thing.
But I think it's
important that it should be stronger in Scotland because the epidemic is in a different scenario. There are more people who are susceptible to it, and it's potentially more dangerous.
But the reason for the national lockdown, I suppose it's easy now with the benefit of hindsight to say it may not have been entirely suitable, but we know more than we did 6, 7, 8 weeks, however many weeks ago it is. And at that point, it was simply a case of this thing is spreading, we don't know enough about it, and we've probably been too slow to lock down, so let's be as draconian as is feasible.
Exactly.
Or the ensuing damage to the economy. You asked Alistair about what's gone wrong on the devolved front. What I think has happened, it's very difficult to know definitively without seeing people at Westminster. So the normal, you can still, as a political reporter or columnist, you can obviously phone people up and regular touch with people, but it's not quite the same as the informality of bumping into people in Portcullis House or Central Lobby or just in the corridors at Westminster and gleaning in a couple of hours lots of insights and gossip about why things have developed as they have. What I do think has happened on the devolved front, and I think it's an area in which Number 10 have made serious mistakes, is that I just don't think they've thought properly about devolution. I can see why that's happened, and I'm a unionist myself, and of course I feel feel annoyance if I see that nationalists are exploiting it in some way. Or I thought Ian Blackford's comments after Boris's statement were particularly ill-judged this week. And then, of course, there's a unionist fear about what the nationalists are how the nationalists could emerge from this stronger. It sounds terrible to talk about political upside from this horrendous experience, but they're politicians, of course, they think like that, even if they deny it. So the unionist impulse would be, this is a UK lockdown, this is a UK response, and Boris is Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and these devolved administrations had better just get used to it. That, I think, would be the frame of mind that I can see Number 10 approaching this problem with. It doesn't really work.
Mm.
And particularly when this crosses over, because it's a devolved function, health, for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. I think Number 10 have behaved in a really crass manner on this. It would have made far more sense in terms of organising efficiently so that the public had a clear sense of things for the devolved administrations to be properly factored in to the decision-making process. They have been consulted, but really bound into the decisions and making the decisions jointly, and also doing that, which would have been the right thing, I think, in terms of messaging and organisation, would also politically make the most sense, weirdly, from Boris Johnson's perspective, because you wouldn't have ended up with this shambles of the last 24, 48 hours where even some Scottish unionists I know are, frankly, really unimpressed with the way that Number 10 has handled things and haven't taken proper account of the devolved experience. To be fair to him, everyone is learning as they go. But I just think they could have been a bit bigger in their attitude on this, and accepted that. I heard someone on the radio saying, well, I think it was Jeremy Vine on his programme, beating up on the Welsh First Minister, just questioning him, why shouldn't this be a UK-wide response? And then Mark Drakeford just politely, calmly pointed out that we've had devolution in the UK for 20 years now, more than 20 years. It is a governing reality, and it's another aspect of the centre's response in London, which has been shown to be, I think, kind of out of date.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I think two things in defence of the government on strategy there. One is that health and social care might be a devolved issue, but finances and the economy and jobs aren't. And if this is going to lead to the greatest recession in 300 years, which is what the Bank of England has said, and it is going to lead into a contraction in the economy of 14% and however much in debt and unemployment, that is going to affect the devolved nations as well. And I doubt that the devolved leaders are at that point going to say, yes, we're going to fund this entirely from the taxpayers of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland and not ask for any central government spending.
Well, they can't. And you've identified, Rachel, that's precisely the row that Boris is walking into. That's the next big row in a week to a fortnight on the devolution question will be that if Scotland's on a different curve and Wales is on a different curve, then what are the consequentials in terms of spending? And that applies particularly on furloughing. So you will hear it said that furloughing has to go on longer in Scotland and Wales than it does in England.
And I think the English people who have been furloughed, myself included, will not take it particularly on the chin if they are being told that their allowance is being cut, or that if their job doesn't exist anymore, that's it, they're being laid off, when equivalent workers in Scotland and Wales are kept on the furlough scheme for longer. And the other thing I think, which is unfortunate, and this is not a defence of Boris Johnson, who I think was pretty appalling yesterday and today from a comms perspective, but he did spend 3 weeks in hospital and recovering from a near-death experience, and in those 3 weeks there really seems to have been a lack of leadership in Westminster, and the devolved leaders, particularly Nicola Sturgeon, kind of stepped up to fill the void. And I think had we had a prime minister in those cabinet meetings and doing those briefings throughout that time, she and the other devolved leaders perhaps would have been involved in the decision-making process in a more cohesive, collegiate way. But because there was no leadership, they stuck their heads above the parapet and became national figureheads even more so than they would otherwise have been, because there wasn't a national prime minister. And now we have a national prime minister again, but that hasn't really gone away. Of course, it would help if he could read his own 50-page government briefing, get the facts right, and deliver an address without going off on tangents. And
does he seem to you, Alistair, to have come back too early? It doesn't look well.
Yes.
Yes, and I think he's been forced to by what we're really talking about on the communication side of it is that this is something we talked about actually quite a lot on the podcast, believe it or not, is how do you create better forums for the union? And whether that's a federal structure or a council of ministers, all the rest, but all of that has to include a more formal series of systems that formalise the relationship between the first ministers and the prime minister. Because I feel too much of it is based on personal either antipathy or sort of whether they get on or how well they work together as individuals. And I don't think that's actually, in an extreme scenario like we had, where Boris was effectively at death's door and was in hospital for a long period, like it doesn't work.
And he also, we've talked as well before about what went wrong in that crucial period. Well, I'm surprised that people were not more agitated about it or concerned about it. We had a constitutional cock up at the UK level, whereby the Prime Minister was incapacitated and then into hospital with no arrangement made for someone to have full prime ministerial authority. Now, the constitutionalist answer and Vernon Bogdanor answer is, well, cabinet government worked, so you had a committee of four, which in itself I think annoys some members of the cabinet. The cabinet has not necessarily been fully involved or consulted, but you had a committee of four senior ministers. And then you had one of them chairing that and chairing cabinet, who's Dominic Raab, the foreign secretary, but he did not have the power to act as prime minister which means that Britain didn't have a prime minister for 3 straight 4 weeks and now has a prime minister back who is somewhat under par and has clearly suffered a near-death experience and is going to take some time to recuperate. I have to say, I couldn't join the sort of cacophony of of outrage on Twitter or social media last night after Boris's performance. I actually thought, and I had low expectations of it because I think the government has really screwed up on the comms. I thought it was okay. I thought it was actually relatively clear. I think one of Boris's strengths, and he's facing a lot of criticism at the moment, is that he does tend to treat people like adults. The underlying assumption is that people are not idiots and that they can work things out and that they can listen. And I suppose the message I took away from it was that we're moving away from mandating stay at home to asking people to use some moral agency and sense. Am I being too kind, Rachel?
No, I liked that bit, and I really, really appreciated him pointing out that this is incredibly difficult for people and that they are just as worried about their livelihoods and the prospects for their children as they are about the health consequences, and mentioning that balance. And I think the government's aim to try and get things moving back to normal slowly in stages is the right one. And I've read the government's briefing, and there are gaps in it, sure, but it does outline very clearly what is going to change when and why and what you can and can't do. The issue for me was that the government briefing came out this afternoon, and there were some contradictions in what Boris Johnson said last night, for example, saying that people would be actively encouraged to go back to work, but not spelling out what protection they might get or how they might get there, saying people shouldn't use public transport, and yet saying they are still expected to go into work. Well, how does that work if you are somewhere where you can't walk or cycle to work or you don't have a car? I think childcare is going to be a huge issue as well. The schools aren't going to open until the start of June at the earliest, and the teachers' unions are actually saying they won't go in even if the government says that they have to. You've got millions of working parents who can't go to work if their children aren't in school, and there's kind of no provision for that. So I think the general message was good, but it was delivered in a way that, as Keir Starmer said, threw up more questions than answers. And it would have been so much better if it had been more scripted, and then the guidance would have come out immediately and you wouldn't have had those 24 hours of confusion and speculation.
It broke all sorts of communications rules. It's just government seems to sort of specialize in some of the worst comms I've ever seen in politics. I would stress one exception though, which is that, remember, they were struggling in comms terms before they came up with the stay at home, save the NHS message, or protect the NHS, save lives thing. And they drafted in their election team. So they did get the comms on an even keel then, when it was a very simple message to communicate about stay at home. So that worked. That was an effective piece of communications, but it's bookended by what came before, which was a shambles on herd immunity, etc. And then now, where things, they just don't seem to think about the basic rules of communication. So one of the main things that Boris should know, having been a Fleet Street journalist, although slightly quixotic one and always suiting himself, is that never do anything Sunday for Monday, because it's always there. In fact, Cummings himself on his blog in 2014, Alex Massey pointed out this morning, Cummings said, don't try and do things on a Monday. It's too complex. And why? And he was talking about pre-coronavirus, obviously. On a Friday, it's difficult to assemble the key people to make the decision. On a Sunday, you're obviously operating with a, if not skeleton staff, then lots of arms of the government are, so people are not all plugged into work. And there's potential for confusion and cock-ups. That's why newspapers tend not to produce big investigations that land on a Sunday for Monday. You want your key team around. Sunday for Monday tends to be a day for to follow up.
And it didn't even have to be Monday, because he said last night, you know, we want you to start going back to work from tomorrow. Now it seems that the guidance is actually from Wednesday, and there are logistical issues. So the Tube are saying, well, there was overcrowding on the Tube today. Well, of course there was, because TfL and public transport weren't given enough notice, and we're kind of scrambling to how are we going to deal with these extra passengers. I'm not one for making excuses for the Mayor of London in general, but I think if you are going to change the advice, you do need to give people time to prepare and make the timings of that really clear, and not being able to decide if it was on Monday or Wednesday. That was just an unnecessary screw up.
One other side effect of the moving to the ministerial, the MAG groups, which is the four who've been running things, reporting to Boris, so Hancock, Gove, Sunak and Raab, is that it's meant the de facto downgrading of COBRA. People always laugh about COBRA, but one thing it did provide, and it's still meeting, but it doesn't seem to have quite the same force, was that it created a framework for what Alistair was describing, for the input of the devolved, formal input of the devolved administrations. Wouldn't it have made much more sense when it was clear in the middle of last week that the briefing was either being misinterpreted or number 10 was mishandling the briefing about this being Freedom Monday? Wouldn't it have been better to fast forward everything, to convene COBRA, to get Sturgeon and the Welsh First Minister and others bought into the decision-making process, agree the stages in which it was going to be released, and then Boris could have said, well, I'm going to go to the House of Commons and update them on my deliberations, and you please do the same in Wales and in Scotland. Do it almost simultaneously, and then simultaneously also release the documents and make a virtue of it. If there was a difference in Scotland or in Wales, the reasons we've described, make a virtue of that being factored into the decision making process, and do it last Thursday in preparation for work, people going back to work on Monday. Now, I know there'll be some people listening saying, well, this is easy with the benefit of hindsight. Of course it's easy with the benefit of hindsight, but it was also obvious at the time, late last week, and lots of us observed that the comms were a shambles, but the comms were being a shambles was also a product of the decision-making process not functioning properly.
There are two things that I think we're talking a lot about the confusion, and I think there's part of it which is good confusion, i.e. people on a social level will now have to work out the appropriate sort of density of social norms they want to follow in relation to infection. So do you want to wear a mask to go to the shop? I haven't been doing that, although I have bought some masks, and maybe I will now and put it on. So that's me making a judgment. But initially that's quite confusing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the guidance at first look, you think, well, you know, why are you only allowed to meet one person rather than two people if they're in the same household? Well, if you're sensible, you can meet both of them. It's probably fine. You just have to make that assumption. But what I do find irritating and confusing, and this is, I think, really important, and it's precisely what you just said there, Ian, is I don't know about everyone else, but I spend almost all my time trying to second guess why the British government are doing stuff. Because they are not being specifically honest about what action is addressing what problem. So, for example, with the different guidance for Scotland, there is clearly a reason for that, and it's because the epidemic is potentially in a different state. I haven't really heard that explained by anyone. I had to look at the ONS figures and work that out for myself. Again, maybe I haven't seen that, or I've not been paying attention. It's also stuff like on the state of the epidemic, all this stuff over R and I are less than one, Okay, good. I like that Boris has said, okay, the R is between 0.5 and 0.9, because at least that's being clear that they don't really know. It's a bit of guesswork. But then going forward saying, oh, we're going to create this super sophisticated monitoring service which allows us to adjust restrictions to match the R is less than one, it's like something that works in a formula but is never going to work in reality. And I think there isn't really enough clarity on that. And I don't know, maybe I've not been paying attention, but it feels all the time like we are not quite involved in the discussion and that we are being basically told what's going to happen.
You posed the question, Alistair, is the government adrift? And I think you think that it is. Is it also, though, the government's getting a lot wrong, I think, as well as getting quite a few things right, but failing to communicate them properly? Is it also the case that punters, all of us, are really just quite weary?
Yeah,
and there's an adjustment going on here, which is that, I mean, I can remember when this started, but when I thought that lockdown was, or something like it, was going to happen, when it was pretty unfashionable to think that, was that I thought this would be a 2-week or a 4-week experience at most, and it's turned out to be much longer. Are people just frustrated and angry that they're realizing that this is going to go on much longer, not necessarily in this form, but that disrupted life is the story of the next year or year and a half?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think they feel patronized. I think Boris Johnson, either in the initial lockdown speech or a few days before, I can't remember, he said, we can get through this in 12 weeks. Well, we're clearly not going to be through it in any sense of the word in 12 weeks' time. And I think the kind of treatment of people up until this point as not being able to even question government decisions has probably led to a bit of resentment, because people feel, I mean, we are a very law-abiding nation, we followed the rules, we did what we were told for 3 weeks, 6 weeks, now 7 weeks, and you don't seem to have kept up your end of the bargain. I actually agree that the government strategy now of, you can loosen up a little bit, but please use your common sense. I've got lots of people saying, oh, the Brits don't have common sense, and they'll show pictures of one or two acts of irresponsible behaviour. I think in general, people have been acting with a huge amount of restraint and civic responsibility and common sense. But they don't feel that the government has been keeping up in the same way. And I think a lot of that is having 3 weeks without a prime minister, which was no one's fault. You can't blame Boris Johnson for that. I also wonder if maybe some of it is also, and this might be me being cynical, some of it is also that we haven't recovered from 4 years of Brexit wars. And we went into this so polarised, with maybe a third of the country thinking that the government could do no wrong because this was the prime minister who got us out of the EU, and a third of the country thinking that he just wanted to kill poor people. We haven't been able to have a sensible debate on it, because every time you try, people will say, well, you're only saying that because you were a Brexiteer or Remainer, and that makes it quite difficult to move forward.
It is fascinating, Rachel, the way in which this has become a proxy for
Brexit. It really has, yeah.
So on both sides, so there are passionate Brexiteers who are seeing any difficult question from the media or from the opposition or any questioning of the strategy as an unpatriotic act. And Twitter and social media are full of them. I notice it's kind of dying away a bit now, as people, I think, realise it's pretty difficult to conclude anything other than that Britain's in that top third of countries, whether we're the worst or end up the 12th worst or the 15th worst. We're getting hit very hard by this virus, but then on the other side, there are anti-Brexit people who I'm still astonished that they tried to try to overturn the referendum. So I shouldn't really be surprised by anything. But it's fascinating to watch some of the stuff that's written and said, everything through the prism of Brexit and a trope about the essential crapness of Britain or of anyone associated with Brexit trying to do anything. I assume that just most of the country is not that actively engaged in these battles, though an academic who's very pro-Brexit, so that doesn't make it hard to work out who it is, there aren't many of those, did say to me that it's a reminder, and that the thing that they want to study afterwards is just a reminder of how emotionally invested tribally people have become invested in politics. So we're so emotionally invested in this because some people see this as the chance to, if you like, almost bring down Boris Johnson, and it may even succeed eventually, which will be punishment for him. And well, they believe he's ultimately leading really an illegitimate government as it stands.
Yeah, just one with an 80-seat majority.
Yes, but built on lies and all the rest of it. You can write the script. I think it's mad, but still, it's.
I just don't see how you could be in this crisis, even if you hate Brexit, and wasn't a huge fan of Brexit. Definitely wasn't a huge fan of Boris, but he is the prime minister we have. I don't see how you can be in the situation and want the government to do badly because it shows that you were right. I would so much rather in that situation be proved wrong and have a functioning economy and a less bad health crisis.
Yeah.
But that's what Suk kind of explains. And I think we have done badly and we have not shielded people who are vulnerable, which Boris gestures towards, but he never fully says that in plain language. We failed to do that. It's couched in a slightly fudgy language, but just to return, I just want to say, because I forgot to say it earlier, all the government guidance is really interesting, because a lot of the pandemic preparedness stuff it lays out is going to be incredibly useful. It's just not for this pandemic, it's for the next one. Because almost all of it is infrastructure which will take literally years to set up and bed in. Like all those networks, the contact tracing, the biosecurity center, the kind of enhanced treatment stuff is just stuff we don't really have at the moment. So we'll look back, I think, on this great burst of energy on pandemics, specifically respiratory illnesses, as an amazing thing. It's just, I don't think it's really going to help.
What's
coronavirus? It's like the fight against HIV. It may not have borne fruit for a long time, but it radically changed our understanding of viruses.
Well, actually, the work towards HIV is possibly helping now. HIV treatments are being used in the giant study that Britain is doing, which again is a huge positive British exceptionalism story. We are running one of the biggest, if not the biggest, trials of possible treatments for COVID-19 patients using treatments that already exist for other conditions, barely mentioned.
Yeah,
I don't think most people know about it.
That feeds back into the, as you were talking about, the culture wars aspect of this. And I think there is something has gone, I don't know what it is, but for example, the obsession on, we had a big argument last week and the week before that on our death toll and the comparison with it, with other countries. Very little of it was edifying. All reflected, was sensitive to how, you know, the differences in recording deaths, all the rest, the variations in population, the structural problems we have in this country. We should be talking about our public health in a much more direct way, but we aren't fully equipped to do that, I think. Why are the outcomes worse in this country? And it might not just be the government response. It might be problems with our own health, with the way we take care of ourselves, with our over-reliance on our public health system, but not enough self-reliance on how we deal with disease. And that's not to minimize the completely unprecedented seriousness of the disease and how it's caught everyone napping. But it's like we can talk in a vacuum endlessly about coronavirus, but it is hitting us really badly for quite obvious, you know, reasons that are things we can change, and that's a good thing.
I'm starting to wonder though if one of the consequences of the crisis is going to be quite different from what we expected. So it's been my view, and you hear this a lot, but broadly my view, that the NHS is so venerated in this crisis for understandable reasons, and because what's happening in terms of the front line, but then also the crisis has revealed some really troubling things about the way in which the quangos work and the way in which the unresponsiveness of the system and its attitude to centralization and all the rest of it. So I thought that this will mean you get zero possibility of reform of government structures or of public health, because whenever you try to reform it, people, those with an interest in protecting the existing system will simply point to the great wave of public outpouring of support for the NHS in its current structure and say you can't touch it at all. Now, I no longer think that will apply, because I think people will be smart enough to separate sympathy for what's going on the front line and the extraordinary bravery and hard work and a clear reckoning about what's gone wrong on public health and just how things need improved. I think the government has already spotted this. You can see in the document, I think that one of the documents that you were referring to, the sort of guidance on lessons that the government is drawing from it, and there is a clear section on the structure of government. Looks as though it's written, possibly troublingly, by Dominic Cummings, but more reassuringly, probably by Michael Gove, about how the crisis has revealed that certain parts of the government machinery simply don't work. And that looks to me like a coded warning that Public Health England, the way in which NHS England operates, devolved regions are obviously a different, and devolved nations and regions are a different matter. But I think there's probably quite serious change coming. Do you think I'm being too optimistic, Alistair?
I think so. I'm not particularly equipped to talk about, for example, some of the my impression definitely of Public Health England is that, and the assorted different arms of NHS, is that it's terrific when you get a lot of coordination and you've got a clear goal and then it follows through. So the treatment trials is a really good example of that.
Yeah.
Which we were talking about. Once you've identified the goal and you get the personnel together, because we've got like lots of countries around the world, we've got great personnel and a great scientific and medical community in this country. Once you get them all coordinated, and that demands, you know, all the things that you need to get coordination, a bit of strategic know-how, personalities, and institutions, then things really do fire and you do get, you know, and I think we'll be better in the latter half of this crisis than we were in the first. Mm-hmm. And that's reflected in the ambition of the new guidance. Mm-hmm. I do think it's genuinely achievable. It will just take years to do. The chap I was talking to, who really gave me insight into this, Professor Martin Landrieu, who's leading the recovery trial, which is the trial into treatments using existing therapies to look at coronavirus, he said something really interesting about the fight against Ebola. He said, in the first wave of Ebola, a lot of treatments, for example, were used against Ebola, but none of them were done in the context of trials. So in short, none of them were done in the context of coordinated institutions or taking an interest, which is what is happening in this country now. So when there was a second epidemic of Ebola in the Congo, no one was any the wiser. But in the second half of this crisis, with all this great infrastructure that we have and all the coordination, we will be far, far better prepared in the future. But that's not to say we haven't done maybe relatively not that well in the first half. You look at Germany, it's much more regionalized, much more responsive. And there's a big hoo-ha going on at the moment in Germany with the lockdown easing, the R rate ticking up. But there is the capacity in Germany to very quickly flick the switch and, on a region and to pull back on certain measures.
Yeah.
We don't actually have that at the moment in a sophisticated way, which is what the government is moving towards. So, you know, and there's very little precedent in human history for national lockdowns. I had a look today. Happened in Yugoslavia in 1970, happens, you know, in Western Samoa, I think. It's not something that is, it's not actually the norm. The norm is quarantine by city or region or district. And the NHS, clearly, the institutional apparatus is not good at thinking like that.
What's your take on that, Rachel? Because it is, for obvious reasons, beyond criticism at the moment. But I know, friends across this political spectrum, people will talk privately about lessons that need to be learned and improvements that need to be made, but no one publicly wants to do anything that suggests that they're not joining in the great sort of national the church service or celebration.
Well, the clapping and the banning of saucepans. I don't know. I'm not optimistic about this. Maybe that's just because I'm going by what people were saying and doing publicly rather than perhaps what they're thinking privately. I wish in this country we could separate our respect and admiration for the healthcare workers and, in fact, anyone who works in the health service, whether they're a cleaner or a porter or any of those services where they are helping deal with those crises. I wish we could separate our thanks for them from our veneration of the institutions. Whenever we talk about the NHS, we compare ourselves to America, whose health system is non-existent, and I could use a lot of profanities about it, which I won't. But other countries in Europe have universal healthcare systems that they don't worship. They being a doctor or a nurse is about saving lives and helping the community, and they are respected professions, but the institution itself isn't put on some kind of pedestal. Like, could you imagine the Germans or the Italians or the French clapping for their health service? No, they're clapping for the people who work there. And the idea that you can't touch the system because it's the system that's keeping everyone alive. No, there are other ways of modelling it and restructuring it, and maybe it would make more sense to break it down a bit and allow it to be more agile on a more localised level. Or perhaps, I mean, there are doctors in the NHS who say that, but I think because maybe we don't have a sense of national pride in as much as other countries do. We started off by saying this peculiarly English phenomenon that we hate ourselves as a nation and we always do ourselves down. Oh yeah, it's the British being a bit useless again. Because we don't have that pride in us as a nation, we've transferred that pride to our health service, which makes it seem rather untouchable.
Can I pose a question, and then we've probably got to wrap things up, haven't we, which is about the economy. And I suppose we were analysing government communications failures and the course of government policy earlier in the podcast, but there'll be some of our listeners who are very anti-lockdown or very sceptical about the way that the government has handled it, who I'm sure will be shouting at the radio or whatever device they're using to listen to this podcast and saying, look, wake up here. The economic damage being done by this type of lockdown and even the moderate changes to it that Boris is announcing this week maybe don't make that much difference economically. That they would encourage us to be more radical in our thinking. And is it feasible to continue something like this lockdown or draconian measures when we know that the death rate below the age of 25 is very small? And that obviously increases decade by decade and hits those over 80 hardest. Is it just economic madness to continue this for much longer, or is there a reckoning coming, Alistair, at some point where people say it's just not feasible to have something like the Great Depression running on for another 6 months, a year, 18 months with successive lockdowns, localized or national, whatever they are. We've got to get the economy going again.
Yes, I find it funny when people criticize, for example, a more flexible lockdown with the sort of accusation, oh, would it be impossible to enforce? Well, we're kind of through the looking glass in terms of what is or isn't possible and what the state can and can't force us to do, given that we're in a national lockdown. I think part of the problem, actually, is that, and this comes back to the point about the science and how far you can be guided by the science in the middle of a pandemic of a new pathogen. I think epidemiologists will often say every pandemic is like your first pandemic. They're all different and they follow different rules. A lot of the interventions we've made over the last few months and have been made across Western Europe have very limited efficacy in terms of their backing in data. School closures, very little evidence to say that slows the effects of coronavirus. There's lots of evidence that it slows the effects of a flu pandemic because children are very infectious with flu, but coronavirus is different. But you can understand why they've been guided by previous knowledge about how flu spreads, where you'd expect it to be passed by children. So the single best intervention, I think, is not a national lockdown. But to me, and I would love to see if there's data on this or a study that can help me think about this, but is very strict enforcement of age-related distinctions, because it is the single best predictor of whether you'll need hospitalization.
Yeah. This will it's guaranteed to infuriate some of our more mature listeners, but I can't see longer term. If we're now thinking of this as an 18 month, 2 year experience, and Boris Johnson says at the end of his document today that it is, we must brace ourselves for the possibility that there is no vaccine, cannot possibly avoid coming to the conclusion that you have to make the easing of the restrictions in some way dependent on age.
Single best way of predicting risk, and it's nothing to do with it, in general, it's the best way of predicting risk. I think this one way of thinking about it is the number of people who've died a bit below the age of 30 is roughly equivalent to a couple of days in which you'd have freak accidents or sudden death, which is terrible, but people do die below the age of 30 in this country for all kinds of reasons. Mm. But it's roughly equivalent to that. So I find it incredible. I mean, I was watching Joe Root, the English cricket captain, on Sky yesterday, who was talking about how the government wants to bring back biosecure sports. And they're going to have to quarantine. The idea may be that the cricket teams will have to quarantine for over 9 weeks while they play sports. That's 9 weeks without seeing their families. Mm-hmm. Incredible idea. All these guys are below the age of 30. They risk of them even being hospitalized by coronavirus is utterly tiny. I mean, it's so trivial as to be meaningless, actually. Mm. So why are they being forced to take these extraordinary measures? And I understand why people are anxious. It's a really serious disease, but it's not serious for most people.
I think the way of looking at it is not from an age discrimination perspective. It's what would happen if you don't phase it out by age. So I completely agree with what Russ Altman was saying a week ago, that you're not going to arrest a pensioner for going outside. That's just not practical or moral. You can change the guidance and you can say, we are going to loosen the lockdown. We're going to advise that people in certain higher risk groups, and that includes by age, don't don't leave their homes, which is what the government is already doing. If over 70s, it says basically be extra vigilant. And the argument in favour of allowing younger people who are of lower risk to go out and resume their social and economic lives is that it will enable the government to target resources more towards the vulnerable groups who need it more. What I've never understood is the idea that it somehow makes life worse for a person of age 75 if someone of 25 is allowed out. If they're not going to go out anyway because they are higher risk and are afraid to do so, then having other people go out doesn't impact them. It may seem unfair, but the world is unfair in lots and lots of ways. Practically, it doesn't improve their life to restrict the freedoms of others. So if you could change the messaging and say, this is not about age discrimination, this is about taking a risk-based approach and making sure that those who need the greatest resources have those resources available, paid for, by the way, by the young people who are out at work, you might be able to get to that kind of balance. But
as Dan Hannan put it, the young in this country are going to be paying for the next, well, however many decades, for the decisions which have been taken in the last 8 weeks in this country, and will be paying for it in terms of higher taxes for a very, very long time. Employment prospects are diminished, to put it mildly. And are we really going to, as he puts it, shout at them for sitting in the park slightly longer than the police think is sensible, based on a misreading of advice which doesn't necessarily make sense? I think the reason that this might be happening, and that Boris, whose instincts, remember, are liberal, and before he had coronavirus, remember how he was, I think, to his credit, didn't like all the talk of a police state, of sending in the police, and he understood that it's policing with consent. So his instincts are not authoritarian, which is a good thing. But I think he's had a near-death experience personally, which has obviously shaped his attitude. And I think he's had something which is potentially, I mean, who knows how the next 6 months of politics will work out and what life there is in Keir Starmer's revival of the Labour Party, which maybe talk about on a subsequent podcast. But he has the potential for this to become a near-death political experience as well. And he must know that he entered this thing 2 or 3 weeks off the pace for reasons which have been picked over by historians for a long time. In February, the government was just too slow, and that means that we were probably 2 or 3 weeks slower as a country on lockdown and measures and ramping up testing and all manner of other things than we should have been. And having done that and knowing what's coming in terms of the public inquiry, that would condition you, wouldn't you, if you were Boris, Rachel, to be more cautious on the way out than you were on the way in?
I think it's partly that. I think it's also partly that Boris is the kind of politician that really wants to be liked, and he has a lot of strengths, but one of his strengths is sort of rhetoric and being a figurehead. And obviously I know he is more than that, but getting to grips with the nitty-gritty of policy detail isn't one of his strong points. I mean, we just had a prime minister where that was her strong point, and she proved absolutely useless at all the other things. So it's not a criticism of him in general. I just think specifically he doesn't have the skill set that you might desire for this, which is to look at all the complicated moving parts, come up with a policy, have conviction in that policy, and then trust himself and his team to sell it to the public. I think he's following the public mood a bit more than he's actually displaying leadership. Is that unfair?
Yeah, no, well, no, not really. Keir Starmer asked him some very, very specific questions. I thought Keir Starmer was very boring. Very boring today. But
I like boring politicians.
I think it's going to come back into fashion at some point. But Keir Starmer asked very precise questions of Boris about what was in the document. It was all very loyally, and on one level, boring and sleep-inducing, but on another level, very revealing. And the most revealing thing about it was that, well, I listened to Boris's response, and if he answered any of those questions about the contradictions within the guide, within the guidance, then I didn't hear an answer or didn't hear a convincing answer to any of it. So we're going to get, people keep talking about how forensic he's going to be as a lawyer, Keir Starmer, but I think we're only at the beginning of that process of Boris being asked lots of questions, which he then struggles to answer. Alistair?
Well, I was just kind of reflecting, well, yeah, one on Keir Starmer, I've almost fell asleep when I was watching it. But that's not the point. I think it came across really well, if you're not a bit soporific. But is there not, is there not, Ian, in your generation, people older than you, do people not worry? I just don't see this very much. Is there not more worry about what is happening to young people, specifically my generation? So I'm 25. Yeah. People, everyone I know is really desperate about the situation and has been desperate about, not just about now, about politics for a long time. And that expressed itself through, you know, looking for a guy like Jeremy Corbyn, who, you know, had, I think, would have done very little useful for young people, but presented himself in that sort of way. Our favourite author is Sally Rooney, who writes these novels about really nasty, sadistic characters who are effectively can only really exist for inflicting pain on each other and find it very difficult to make connections and feel it's like this eternal adolescence of pain and nastiness. And I just think there's something curdling and something going awfully.
There is.
I've been talking about snowflakes and millennials and all that, but there is something deeply wrong and something deeply contaminated about people below the age of 40 in this country, and it hasn't had.
I'm not sure that's not new. That applied in the 80s. That applied in the 60s.
Well, that applied during the Plague of Athens.
Yes, but it's nothing. There's no real concern about it. There's just this blithe. Oh well, you know. But I don't.
Well, I just think that's probably on the part of. I can't speak for all oldies, but as someone in late 40s, I think that's something which that just happens in historical cycles. And by the time you get to your 40s, you become a bit jaundiced about it, and just think, well, our generation went through something similar. However, I think you raise a really good point, Alistair, which is, but I wouldn't despair on that front. I think lots of older people are deeply worried about it. I think there are two components to about the impact on your generation and the generation below you. I'm more worried about the generation below you.
Yeah, I agree.
In that, I think being the sort of quarantining around to 14 to 18, and the losing those experiences that you have once you've finished your A levels, or goodness knows what first years at university are going to be like. Are universities going to be what we think of as university? Are people going to have a freshers week? And those formative experiences, I think that being lost and people just idling at that age is psychologically very troubling. I've less concern about your generation, or phrase that another way, I have more faith in your generation. And I think
that's nice. No one ever has faith in our generation.
No, I think I think you're probably experiencing your own version of the 1970s, just of things being really quite crap and boring and there not being a lot of hope. I think you will, as a generation, it's difficult to generalise, but I think there'll be a huge surge in entrepreneurialism, I think, and dynamism, because you're going to have to invent your way out of this and start companies and do stuff. And I know that there will be lots of people who that won't be their experience, and there'll be a lot of unemployed people. I'm not dismissing that, but I think there will be a surge of creative energy, And I think you'll probably be more, even more, I know you're particularly interested in liberty, Rachel, as a theme, but I think you'll be conditioned by this to be even more skeptical about government or about state authority, and more interested in economic and cultural freedom, which I think would be a good thing.
And drugs.
Yeah.
Drug freedom.
I don't know anything about that. I was always more of a booze person.
Can I say two things? One of which is depressing, one of which is more lighthearted, to wrap up. The generation that I'm actually most worried about are the young, really young ones, like kids under the age of 12. And I know kids are resilient and they bounce back, but there are children at the moment, like young children, who haven't seen another child in 2 months. I'm not a child psychologist, but I just don't think that can be good for child development.
And they're very young, but so below the age of one. I mean, I was hearing from someone else on the reaction team was flagging up the impact on just the consequences, the unintended consequences in terms of immunology, about what happened.
Yeah.
That children, by it's not just a socializing thing, it's the obviously resistance you pick up to bugs just by being out and about and contact.
Yeah, my friend's got a 6-month-old baby and is really worried about that. And also that there are a lot of children who are missing school at the moment. And yes, there are lots of children who are being homeschooled excellently and there are online lessons for them. But the ones who were already the most disadvantaged are clearly not getting that support, and are probably never going to catch up. And just the way we as a nation have just decided that 2 months of lost education, possibly a year's worth of disrupted education for an entire generation, doesn't matter. Yeah. That has really surprised me. I've been wondering, where are the think of the children? I'm not normally a think of the children person.
Think of the children.
We just seem to have accepted that that's fine. So that's the depressing thing. The flippant thing is Alistair mentioned Sally Rooney. I finally sat down to watch Normal People, that everyone of every demographic, every age group, every political persuasion on Twitter has been raving about. I hated it. I'm 2 episodes in. Does it get better? It is slow, it is self-indulgent, it's got pretty camera work. I have no interest in either of the characters. What's wrong with me?
But they have no interest in the rest of the world. That's the point. It's about...
But why am I meant to be interested in them?
Well, because, you know, it shows dysfunction operating on a...
No. Do you know what I think? I think it's a lot of people watching it and it's making them either sort of nostalgic for the school or university sweetheart, or very sad about the one who got away, when they look at who they're currently partnered with, and that's why people are watching it. It's basically a form of BBC porn.
I think it's popular for those reasons, but it's popular. I mean, it actually chimes on a deeper level, and I don't think it's amazing telly. And I really don't like the novel.
Do I have to watch more episodes?
But it does touch a nerve, which is, I think, this inability to relate to the world, and only to be able to relate to another person who shares in some sort of deep self-loathing. But anyway, I was just thinking about children. I just got shivers imagining how much my mum would have relished me just being at home for months, and her, because she's a teacher, she would have set me the most demanding curriculum you've ever imagined. Would have been horrifying. But that's very particular. And I do worry whether whatever it takes to, you know, save lives and protect the NHS is, you know, particularly in early years, if you talk about the investment you make into 0 to 4-year-olds, that completely determines life outcomes.
Yeah.
Quite a big, you know, there's loads of studies. If you don't, there's not enough investment in early years and not enough contact and all the rest, you're seriously debilitating people.
Well, I've been educating my 3-year-olds about democracy and constitutional rights, and one of them's decided she's going to be prime minister when she grows up. So there is hope.
Well, that's good. Yeah, we've certainly learned in this crisis that we need more people to be interested in going into politics, I think. Do you think it's a polite way of putting it? Anyway, I think on that note, then, we'll wrap up for today. We've gone way over our allotted time. Not that we have an allotted time, but there's so much interesting stuff to talk about. If you're not a Reaction subscriber, go to the website www.reaction.life and become a subscriber. If you are a subscriber, or you sign up in the next 24, 48 hours, you get an invite to come to the first of the Zoom events that we're doing on Zoom, with me interviewing Matt Ridley, biologist, best-selling author, thinker, writer, who's been really, really interesting and instructive on the coronavirus crisis since it started. And I'm going to be interviewing him at noon on Wednesday, the 13th of May. And it's a subscriber-only event for about an hour. And there's a chance to ask Matt questions. And we'll also be talking about his new book, which is How Innovation Works. So sign up and join in for that. But until next time, thank you very much for listening.